Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 886. What the hell does Dave Emery mean by the Earth Island Boogie Part 3, Geopolitical Quicksand? This program is being recorded on January 17th of the year 2016. In this program, we are going to, I can't say that we will be wrapping up our analysis of events in and around the Earth Island, because those are not only very important, but ongoing, and will no doubt continue to be so for quite some time. But what we're going to be doing is looking at some developments, both past, and we're going to be prognosticating about developments in the future, about the Earth Island Boogie, and what I think might very well turn out to be a scenario in which elements that we have promoted will turn on and ultimately perhaps destroy, certainly wound very carefully the U.S., not unlike in the fashion that Al-Qaeda, which grew out of, at one level, the Muslim Brotherhood, at another level, the use by American intel of Islamists as proxy warriors, first against the Soviet Union, and later in the Balkans, in the former Yugoslavia, and more recently against Russia in the Caucasus, and also China in Xinjiang province. Ultimately, the Frankenstein's monster that we created and that we used turned on us. I don't think that, at least up to a point, that was a source of great concern to a number of elements who certainly welcomed that turning against the U.S. as something of a strategy of tension gambit that would justify a crackdown on civil liberties and censorship of the media. I do not think that was, by any stretch of the imagination, the primary goal of the use of Islamists. Again, the use of Islamists as proxy warriors, and at another level, the use of the Muslim Brotherhood because of its corporatist free market economics, something that was very much to the liking of transnational corporate interests. The World Bank, among others, viewed Ibn Khaldun, the chief Muslim Brotherhood's economic theoretician. He actually predates the Muslim Brotherhood by several centuries, but he is viewed by the World Bank as the first real advocate of privatization. That, in a nutshell, will give you an idea of how the transnational corporate interests and their allied political and national security elites view the Muslim Brotherhood. And again, the utility of Islamists and what the brilliant Peter Lavenda termed weaponized Islam as proxy warriors, something that gathered momentum during the First World War and then concretized in a much greater way during World War II, and still more gathered still more momentum during the Cold War. That also is a major, major element in this. It is my belief and fear that ultimately those same weaponized Islamist elements and the corporatist Muslim Brotherhood, being so ardently courted by elements of U.S. intelligence and still apparently being used as proxy warriors in Central Asia and in the Caucasus in Russia, I think ultimately that is going to prove to be a Frankenstein's monster. And I think ultimately, as I articulated in a number of programs, including the long series on the Arab Spring, as it was called, one of the Conga Line ops that we looked at in, for the record, 885. I think ultimately they are going to be used by the underground Reich to destroy, basically, their either destroy or subjugate their political opponents from World War II. Russia, China, the U.S., Britain, France, and ultimately, I think, Israel will be wiped off the face of the earth by these very same elements. In this program, we're going to be taking a look at some things that I talked about in November and December of 2005, more than 10 years ago. And we're going to be recouping some of those lines of discussion. This is admittedly a very involved line of analysis, so I can't stress strongly enough that interested listeners use the other programs and the printed descriptions of those broadcasts, all of them available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website, which contains all of my lifetime's work, again, for download for free. In For the Record 535, among other programs, I talked about something that goes against the conventional political wisdom. In the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, and also in its aftermath, the notion of an alliance between Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein was poo-pooed by both, by the left primarily. The right had it wrong as well. There, in fact, was no discernible participation by Saddam Hussein in September 11th. And, of course, the most ill-advised and ill-fated U.S. invasion of Iraq, something George W. Bush, that is, had foreshadowed in a 1999 interview, even before he was nominated to be the Republican candidate for president in 2000, something we spoke about with Russ Baker in his Family of Secrets book and the interviews with him that I did for the record 711 through 716, done in 2010, that ill-advised and ill-fated U.S. invasion of Iraq has unleashed a Pandora's box of horrible things, which then gained further momentum due to the Arab Spring. In fact, the available evidence suggests that there actually was a relationship between Saddam Hussein and the bin Laden organization. What that relationship was something of a doomsday scenario, mindful of the possibility that the Americans could once again invade his country. Ironically enough, by the way, as some of my prognostications about elements that U.S. intel had created turning on us, bear in mind that originally Saddam Hussein was installed by the CIA. Ultimately, he became an enemy of the U.S., and I would note that, mindful of the possibility that the U.S. could finish what they began during the Gulf War of the early 90s, Saddam Hussein worked out a doomsday agreement with bin Laden and al-Qaeda. The basic thrust of the situation was that in the event that the Americans knocked Saddam Hussein out of the box in Iraq, then Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda would serve as something of a backup basically they would back up Saddam Hussein and carry out attacks against American and Israeli targets. By the same token, if the U.S. knocked bin Laden out of the box in Kabul in Afghanistan, then the Iraqis would serve as something of a backup for bin Laden. Now, as we have seen, of course, both took place. The U.S., despite the fact that Saddam Hussein was not in any way involved in September 11th, we went ahead and invaded anyway, unleashing the Pandora's box that we now see to a considerable extent in the Middle East. Also, we invaded Afghanistan and knocked bin Laden and Al-Qaeda out of the box there. So both took place. And again, the nature of the relationship was one of backup, basically, even though there were significant differences between the Ba'ath Party and Saddam Hussein and bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Because of their mutual enmity against the U.S. and also Israel, they served as something of a backup for each other. Information about that in the book In the Name of Osama Bin Laden, authored by Roland, R-O-L-E-N-D, Jacquard, J-A-C-Q-U-A-R-D, published in softcover by Duke University Press. And we read about that backup arrangement as follows. Discussing the conventional wisdom that there was no relationship between Saddam Hussein and bin Laden, we read, it appears, however, that this version is the publicly admissible one, the one that can pass political muster. According to the same sources, there was another scenario more in keeping with the calculating mentality of Saddam Hussein and his secret services. In 1998, after declining all offers that had been made to them through official diplomatic channels, those services are reported to have established a secret operational connection with bin Laden in Manila and in Kashmir. It was indeed difficult for Iraq to ignore an Arab like Osama bin Laden, who so effectively humiliated the Americans. Colonel Khairallah al-Takriti, the brother of the head of Mukhabarat, the Iraqi intelligence service, is reported to have been named case officer for the connection. The arrest of two Moroccan associates of bin Laden in Rabat on November 11, 1998, made it possible to establish the link with certainty. According to Western sources, the Iraqi services have sought to secure the assistance of bin Laden's networks in case Iraq were again to be attacked by the U.S. in order to carry out attacks against American targets in Arab countries. Skipping down, according to Arab sources, in anticipation of a foreseeable reversal of alliances in Kabul, bin Laden had been in discreet contact since September of 2000 with associates of Uday Hussein, another of Saddam's sons. The ground for that agreement was the anti-Israeli and anti-American battle. Bin Laden and the Iraqis are said to have exchanged information about chemical and biological weapons, despite the opposition of some of the Baghdad leadership, including Tariq Aziz. Well, again, although certainly again, the invasion of Iraq was ill-advised, and there was no participation by Saddam Hussein in the September 11th attacks, unlike elements of the Saudi secret services, elements of the Pakistani secret services, and elements of German intelligence as well. The Iraqis were not involved in September 11th. Nonetheless, we went out and we invaded Iraq. We didn't invade Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, or Germany. And I would note that both Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden were knocked out of the box. Well, now we skip ahead to today, and we're going to talk about the Arab Spring, which set the stage. Again, that too was a U.S. intelligence operation. It was one of the Conga Line ops. The bloodbath currently enveloping Syria is a direct outgrowth. The Syrian civil war is a direct outgrowth of the Arab Spring. The Arab Spring also led to the ouster of Muammar Gaddafi and the rise of Islamist groups in Libya, including and especially ISIS, which is using Libya as a major basis for projection of power into Africa, as is Al-Qaeda.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
One of the things that should be weighed very carefully in connection with the passage from Ramajakal's In the Name of Osama bin Laden that I just read is the fact that in addition to the presence of Chechen fighters in ISIS, and in the past we have looked at the combat prowess of Chechens that was viewed by American Special Operations Forces as having helped to cement the considerable combat prowess of ISIS. I would note, too, that through, as we examined in For the Record 382, and once again as we looked at in For the Record 773, there are very firm indications that once again the Chechens are being used as Islamist proxy warriors by elements of U.S. intelligence. And yet, the Chechen Islamists have turned on the U.S., and the Boston Marathon bombing appears to have been but one of the many elements of blowback from that. Now, in addition to the Chechens, former Iraqi military officers who are allied with the Ba'ath Party and Saddam Hussein are playing a primary role in the combat operations of ISIS, the Islamic State. We're going to examine that. As we do, we want to reflect, I think, on that passage from the Jakal text and ask ourselves to what extent this is a fulfillment of a manifestation of that doomsday backup arrangement between Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, and Saddam Hussein and his Ba'ath Party. Saddam is gone, he's dead, so is Osama bin Laden. To what extent are the circumstances I'm about to relate an outgrowth of that doomsday backup scenario that Jakal wrote about in 2002. The following is from the Frontline program of October 28th, 2014. It is available on the pbs.org website. This is by Jason M. Breslow, B-R-E-S-L-O-W. How Saddam's former soldiers are fueling the rise of ISIS. And bear in mind that, as we have seen, the head of ISIS, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, is a, quote, former, unquote, note the quotes, of the Muslim Brotherhood. Of the significant role of the former Iraqi Army Officer Corps in ISIS, and bearing in mind how some of their considerable combat prowess comes from the Chechen Islamists who have been the beneficiaries of U.S. covert operations in Central Asia, we read, as the Islamic State continues its march through Syria and Iraq, the jihadist group is quietly utilizing a network of former members of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party to help militarize a fighting force that has effectively erased the border between both nations and left roughly 6 million people under its rule. The extent of this seemingly mismatched alliance is detailed in a new report by the New York-based intelligence firm, the Soufan Group, that's S-O-U-F-A-N. Despite a deep philosophical divide between ISIS and the Ba'ath Party, the two sides have found, quote, sufficient coincidence of interest to overcome any ideological disagreement, unquote, the analysis, which will be released on Wednesday, found. This marriage of convenience, as the report's author Richard Barrett describes it, can be seen through the ISIS hierarchy. The current head of the group's military council, for example, is believed to be Abu Ahmed al-Awlani, an ex-member of Saddam Hussein's army. So too was al-Awlani's predecessor. Another member of the military council, Abu Muhammad al-Sweidawi, S-W-E-I-D-A-W-I, was once a lieutenant colonel in Hussein's air defense intelligence, but by early 2014 was heading ISIS operations in western Syria, according to the report. Similarly, two deputies to the Islamic State's self-proclaimed caliph, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, are former Ba'athists. Abu Muslim al-Afari al-Turkmani, T-U-R-K-M-A-N-I, is believed to have been a senior special forces officer and a member of military intelligence in Hussein's army. Today, as Baghdadi's number two, he supervises ISIS operations in Iraq. The second deputy, Abu Ali al-Anbari, A-N-B-A-R-I, oversees operations in Syria. Both men are also thought to serve on the Islamic State's main governing body known as the Shura Council. Even the appointment of al-Baghdadi to lead the Islamic State of Iraq in 2010 is reported by an ISIS defector to have been engineered by a former Ba'athist, Haji Bakr, B-A-K-R, an ex-colonel from the Iraqi Revolutionary Guard. Bakr, quote, initially attracted criticism from fellow members of the group for his lack of a proper beard and lax observance of other dictates of their religious practice, unquote, the report notes, again quoting, but his organizational skills, knowledge of the Iraqi army, and network of fellow ex-Ba'athists made him a valuable resource, unquote. It's this type of expertise and network of connections that has made former Ba'athists so valuable to the Islamic State, says Barrett. Case in point, he says, is the long-term planning and preparation seen in the Islamic State's capture of Nineveh province and its capital, Mosul, in June of 2014. As he writes of the campaign, this is not the work of neophyte enthusiasts inspired by their imagined rewards of martyrdom. It is clearly the result of detailed planning by people who know Iraq well, have prior experience and training, and are able to manage an organization with discipline and secrecy. All characteristics of Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist supporters. So again, a major element in the military success of ISIS is the primary presence of parts of Saddam Hussein's officer corps. And also bear in mind that some of their combat prowess as well stems from their use of Chechen warriors. Both of these basically elements of blowback from some of our operations in the Earth Island. The Earth Island, of course, that stretch of land going from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe, the Middle East, Russia, China, and India. It comprises most of the world's landmass, as well most of the world's population, most of the world's natural resources, including fossil fuels, and across the middle of the Earth Island, or World Island, as it is also known, is a large stretch of Muslim population, or a large area inhabited primarily by Muslims. And for that reason, effective use or control of the Muslim population has long been seen as a gambit to control the Earth Island. Now, again, I would note that the bloody civil war in Syria is a direct outgrowth of the so-called Arab Spring, one of the Conga Line ops that I spoke about in For the Record 885, and indeed in our series about the Arab Spring, go from 734 through 739. I said this, the Arab Spring that was being hailed by everybody saying, oh, isn't this wonderful? I said, no, it is going to bring the Muslim Brotherhood to power. That is the idea. And it is going to be devastating in its ramifications. Well, the bloodbath in Syria is a direct outgrowth of the Arab Spring. It could very easily mushroom into a third world war. And so, too, the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi, not exactly a day at the beach himself, but his overthrow has opened up Libya as a major area of operations for Islamist groups, including Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And furthermore, that appears to be, Libya, that is, again, the overthrow of Gaddafi being another element of the Arab Spring, another outgrowth of the Arab Spring. That has opened up Libya as a major base of operations and force projection by both ISIS and Al-Qaeda. The New York Times of January 1st of 2016 has an article by Carlotta, C-A-R-L-O-T-T-A, Gall, G-A-L-L. Jihadists deepen collaboration in North Africa. And this reads in part as follows. Skipping down. Many of the extremist groups are affiliates of Al-Qaeda, which has had roots in North Africa since the 1990s. With the recent introduction of Islamic State franchises, the jihadist push has been marked by increasing, sometimes heated, competition. But analysts and military officials say there is also deepening collaboration among groups using modern communications and a sophisticated system of roving trainers to share military tactics, media strategies, and ways of transferring money. Their threat has grown as Libya, with its ungoverned spaces, oil, ports, and proximity to Europe and the Middle East, has become a budding hub of operations for both Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State to reach deeper into Africa. And as Africa's jihadists come under the wing of distant and more powerful patrons, officials fear that they are extending their reach and stitching together their ambitions, turning once local actors into pan-national threats. So again, we have Al-Qaeda and ISIS in Libya, which, like the Syrian civil war, that situation is an outgrowth of the Arab Spring. Now, this admittedly complicated line of analysis takes a look at what the U.S. is doing, and we're going to ask ourselves, basically, to what extent the German-slash-underground Reich hand in the U.S. glove is going to be using the Islamist warriors that U.S. intel and the transnational corporate interests and their allied national security and political elites are using to establish corporatist economics throughout the Muslim world, and also as proxy warriors in against Russia and China, following on the heels of their use as proxy warriors against the Soviet Union and the former Yugoslavia. Reading now from Occidentalis of December 13th of 2004, an article called The Reds, the Browns, and the Greens by Alexandra Del Valle, D-E-L, and capital V-A-L-L-E. And this is a footnote, and it is referencing Testament of Adolf Hitler Headquarters of the Führer, February 4th to April 2nd of 1945. This preface is by François Genoux, a very important character, deeply involved with the Bank Altaqua, according to some sources, having actually founded the Bank Altaqua, which carried an unlimited line of credit in an account for Al-Qaeda. Genoux was heir to the political last will and testament, and collected literary works of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels. And in, again, the last will and testament of Adolf Hitler, Headquarters of the Führer, February 4th to April 2nd of 1945, we read, skipping down, Adolf Hitler declared in his testament, reported by Martin Bormann, quote, all of Islam vibrates at the announcement of our victories. What can we do to help them? How can it be to our interest and our duty? The presence next to us of the Italians creates a malaise among our friends of Islam. It hinders us from playing one of our better cards to support the countries oppressed by the British. Such a policy would excite enthusiasm throughout Islam. It is, in effect, a particularity of the Muslim world that what touches one, whether good or ill, is felt by all the others. The people ruled by Islam will always be nearer to us than France, in spite of the kinship of blood.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
So again, the use of what people have been referred to as weaponized Islam, formulated by Germany in World War I. The British then adopted that to an extent with the Arab Legion of Lawrence of Arabia. Then the Germans used that to great advantage in World War II. And then it was adopted by Western Intel, CIA in particular, during the Cold War. That ultimately led to Al-Qaeda, among other institutions. What we're going to do is to take a look at something I spoke about in For the Record program number 535 called Death Trap. Again, from November of 2005, more than 10 years ago, there was a meeting in the spring of 2002 between a number of fascist leaders of Europe and Ahmed Huber. Ahmed Huber was a director of the bank Al-Taqwa and very close to the Turkish Islamist Party, initially the Refah Party, which then gave rise to the AKP of Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey. This is from Report on Islamists, the Far Right, and Al-Taqwa by the brilliant Kevin Coogan, author of the book Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yaki and the Post-War Fascist International, one of the most important books ever written about fascism and a must for any serious student of the topic of this meeting in the spring of 2002. Now, again, we have Ahmed Huber, a director of the bank Al-Taqwa, protege of Francois Janu, protege of the Grand Mufti, and a protege of Johann von Leers, who became Omar Amin von Leers. He was initially in charge of anti-Semitic propaganda for Joseph Goebbels' propaganda ministry for the Third Reich, and later became director of the Institute for the Study of Zionism under Nasser in Egypt. Ahmed Huber was present at this meeting, as was Jean-Marie Le Pen, the founder of the Front National, the French fascist party that has garnered a great deal of political currency from the influx of North African and Muslim refugees into France. That same thing is also driving the political spectrum very far to the right elsewhere around Europe. And For the Record 882, I termed that the perfect storm. More about that in future programs. Also present at this meeting were Franz Schoenhuber, a founder of the Republikaner Party in Germany and a member of the SS, and also Gianfranco Fini. He is head of the Alleanza Nazionale, the, quote, post-fascist, unquote, party, an admirer of Mussolini, and someone who was very closely connected to the P2 milieu in Italy. There are a number of evidentiary tributaries stretching from the P2 milieu to the bank Al-Taqwa, including one of the other directors of bank Al-Taqwa. That director was a member of the Ordine Nuovo, that was an Italian fascist terrorist group headed up by Pino Rauti, and that was part of the general P2 nexus along with Gianfranco Fini. Again, Fini, Jean-Marie Le Pen, Ahmed Huber, an unnamed American fascist, and Franz Schoenhuber of the Republikaner Party are present at a meeting in the spring of 2002. Now, recall that the curveball, disinformation, that was a fellow who said that Saddam Hussein had mobile biological warfare weapons laboratories. That turned out to be disinfo, but he was basically handled by the BND, by German Intel, CIA never got very good access to him, but that disinformation was one of the things cited by the Bush administration to justify the invasion of Iraq. Another was a piece of disinformation that was generated by the SISMI, that S-I-S-M-I, that is the Italian Intelligence Service, very close to the same P2 milieu of Gianfranco Fini, that director of the Bank Alpaca, who was tied to Ordine Nuovo, and that involved the alleged securing of yellow cake uranium from Niger by Saddam Hussein. That was disinformation. The question I asked in For the Record 535, and what I am asking again, is to what extent curveball handled by BND and the Niger yellow cake disinformation provided by the P2 connected CISMI were deliberately placed in front of the marauding American bear, rather like placing honey in front of a marauding bear in order to lure it into a trap. And one of the things that I asked in For the Record 535, and that I ask again, did this meeting that we are going to be talking about, did it have anything to do with the feeding of false intelligence to the U.S. in order to lure the U.S. into a dreaming, expensive, and ultimately fatal war with the Muslim population of the Earth Island? And again, that is what I wrote in November of 2005 in For the Record 535. That doesn't seem quite so crazy now, does it? Now, again, reading from about this meeting, which I suspect may have been intended to provide the disinformation to the marauding American bear, rather like setting out a pot of honey. Didn't require a lot of guile under the circumstances, given the gall that the Bush administration was demonstrating of this meeting in the spring of 2005. Perhaps the most remarkable story concerning Huber comes from a brief item in the Swiss tabloid Blick, B-L-I-C-K, that in an April 26, 2002 article by Alexander Sauter, S-A-U-T-T-E-R, that Huber was involved in a meeting of far-right leaders from Europe. A photo showing Huber with Jean-Marie Le Pen accompanies the article. The Blick article available on the web is as follows. Mont Pelerin VD, Christian Cambuzat, C-A-M-B-U-Z-A-T, the promoter of the right extremist Jean-Marie Le Pen. The guru assembles together some of the top leaders of the European right. On the idyllic Mont Pelerin, they debate their crude ideas. At his secret visit to a spa in Switzerland, Le Pen hardly remained alone. Righteous leaders from all over Europe traveled to meet the extremist presidential candidate who was hosted by Cambuzat. Franz Schoenhuber, founder of the Republican Party in Germany and a former member of the SS. He talked with Le Pen, who constitutes, together with Schoenhuber, the Front National faction in the European Parliament. Gianfranco Fini, Italian post-fascist Mussolini admirer and founder of the Alleanza Nazionale. He also was at the meeting with Le Pen and Schoenhuber. Ahmed Huber, the Swiss, is on the Bush administration blacklist. I met Le Pen at Mont Pelerin as he went to Christian Cambuzat's spa, Huber told Bleak yesterday. At the extremist rendezvous, an American far-right politician was also supposed to have taken part. The American, by the way, is not identified. Christian Cambuzat said that Le Pen, after the election, had again become the sharpest weapon of the Front National because Le Pen changed his image from a venomous old man to a kindly U.S. TV evangelist. And again, note that along with Huber, Karim Alessandro Gay of the Ordine Nuovo was also a member, director of the Bank Alpaca. And there are strong links between the Banco Alpacua and the Banco del Gottardo in Switzerland that was used for the unpublished accounts in Clearstream that may have been used to help finance September 11th. The Banco del Gottardo was formerly the Swiss branch of the Banco Ambrosiano. Now, bearing in mind, again, we're going to be taking a look at some interesting developments with regard to Turkey and with regard to an organization called the Fethullah Gulen Organization. That's F-E-T-U-L-L-A-H. And the second word is G-U-L-E-N. That is a major Turkish-based or Turkish Islamist organization. Fethullah Gulen is now based in Pennsylvania. It is huge. It is worldwide with millions of followers. It has been claimed to be a CIA front, not only by people in Central Asia, but also by a former chief of Turkish intelligence and also by the whistleblower Sibel Edmonds. It is also claimed both by Ms. Edmonds and by observers in Central Asia to be an extremist organization. And yet there has been alleged CIA participation with that organization. We're going to be taking a look at Turkey, which again has been manifesting all of its Islamic fascist roots. Erdogan recently expressed oblique admiration for Adolf Hitler, of all people. And we're going to be taking a look at Erdogan and the alleged CIA and alleged Islamist extremist organization Fethullah Gulen, formerly one of Erdogan's closest political allies, but now an organization that is facing some of the very repressive machinery or machinery of repression that they had formerly helped to forge for Erdogan. What we're going to be doing here is asking basically why. Why has the alleged CIA and alleged Islamist extremist organization of Fethullah Gulen, formerly an ally of Erdogan, why has Erdogan turned on it? Is it because Erdogan was initially collaborating with the CIA and now, like Al-Qaeda and other Islamists, is now turning against U.S. or certainly against CIA? And is that because he is going to align himself or is aligning himself with, at one level, the underground Reich and at others, the Islamists? Reviewing from GermanForeignPolicy.com of February 18th of 2011. The Turkish model, skipping down. The focus is on two particular aspects of Turkish policy. The first is that over the past few years, political Islam in Turkey has proven to be very cooperative with the EU, skipping down. It is on this basis that Erdogan's AKP has established intensive ties to Europe and incorporated into its brand of political Islam a reorientation favorable to the EU. The party has since stood as a model for the possibility of Islamism having a pro-Western character. In fact, over the past few years, several North African Islamic forces, including sectors of the influential Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, have been orienting themselves on the AKP. According to a recent study co-financed by the SPD-affiliated Friedrich Ebert Foundation, nearly two-thirds of the populations in seven Arab nations, including Egypt, would be in favor of their countries adopting the Turkish model. A pro-Western orientation of the Muslim Brotherhood implicit in such a model would be appreciated in Western capitals. And indeed, in many pronouncements that we have looked at in For the Record 790 and For the Record 830 and others, the pro-corporatist economics of the Muslim Brotherhood have found great favor. And I would note that one of the people who has been one of the most visible and active advocates of the Muslim Brotherhood, none other than Graham Fuller, who also was CIA station chief in Kabul when the Islamists were used as proxy warriors against the former Soviet Union. More about Graham Fuller in just a minute.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
About the Gulenist movement, from the EurasiaNet.org blog of January 6th of 2011, is the CIA infiltrating Central Asia via Turkish Muslims? This by Joshua Kocera, K-O-C-E-R-A, skipping down. That apparently is the claim of former top Turkish intelligence official Osman Nuri Gundes, G-U-N-D-E-S, who has published a memoir alleging that the Fethullah Gulen movement has been sheltering CIA agents in Central Asia since the 1990s. According to the Washington Post spy blog talk, quote, in the 1990s, Gundes alleges the movement sheltered 130 CIA agents at its schools in Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan alone. The Gulen movement already is a controversial one in Central Asia, with governments cracking down to varying degrees because of the group's alleged Islamist or pan-Turkic bent. And that is without allegations of being a CIA stalking horse. Skipping down again. Anyway, Sibel Edmonds, the FBI translator turned whistleblower, says that account doesn't go far enough, and the Gulen movement is an extremist Islamist one, and that the CIA is cooperating with them nevertheless. Quote, based on what I personally know, U.S. Islamization operations in Central Asia via Gulen started in late 1997 or early 1998. Unquote. I would add that would not be a surprise at all. I would note that the Gulen movement was formerly a close ally of the Erdogan regime and helped in their oppression or suppression or repression of political opponents. And Paul Krugman, in his Conscience of a Liberal blog in the New York Times of March 12th of 2012, featured an article called A Moscow Show Trial on the Bosporus by Dani, D-A-N-I, Rabrik, R-A-B-R-I-K. I'm probably mispronouncing many or most of these Islamic or Arab and or Turkish names. This reads in part, in what is probably the country's most important court case in at least five decades, hundreds of Turkish military officers are in jail and on trial for allegedly having plotted to overthrow the then newly elected Justice and Development Party back in 2003. The case also happens to be one of the most absurd ever prosecuted in an apparent democracy. The evidence against the defendants is such an obvious forgery that even a child would recognize it as such. Imagine, if you can, something that is a cross between the Moscow show trials and the Salem witchcraft hysteria, and you will not be too far off. Skipping down. But the real moving force behind this and a number of other similar trials is the Gulen movement, a key ally of Erdogan's government, made up of the followers of the Pennsylvania-based Turkish Muslim preacher Fethullah Gulen. Gulenists have a long track record of framing their perceived opponents and engaging in judicial dirty tricks. Their control of key positions in the national police and judiciary enables them to mount targeted operations disguised as legal investigations. Prosecutors scrutinizing them, whistleblowers revealing their activities, critical journalists, and even businessmen have been among their victims, in addition to military officers. As Ahmet Sik, S-I-K, a journalist who wrote an expose about the movement and then found himself facing preposterous charges of helping terrorists even before the book was published, exclaimed on his way to jail, he who touches the goonless movement burns, unquote. The police and prosecutors who have staged the coup plot trial are known Gulen sympathizers. And Gulenist media have worked overtime to shape public opinion, whipping up hysteria against the defendants and producing a steady stream of disinformation about the case. So again, the repressive machinery of the Avalon government, which is a direct Muslim Brotherhood outgrowth, as we have looked at in For the Record 884, among other programs, was formally allied with the Gulen movement. And one of the people poo-pooing the notion that the Gulen movement was a CIA front is none other than Graham Fuller, arguably the best known and effective advocate of Islamism and of the use of the Muslim Brotherhood and its corporatist economics, and also the use of Islamists as proxy warriors. And his defense, his poo-pooing of the notion of the Gulen movement as, in effect, a CIA front, I think can be seen as pro forma. No good intelligence officer worth his or her salt, and certainly Fuller is that, would spill the beans, so to speak, about an intel front such as CIA. So his poo-pooing of the notion that the Gulen organization might be a CIA front in Central Asia and perhaps Turkey as well can be seen against the routine procedure of an intelligence officer in these circumstances. The Washington Post of January 5th of 2011 has an article by Jeff Stein, S-T-E-I-N. Islamic group is CIA front, ex-Turkish intel chief says. A memoir by a top former Turkish intelligence official claims that a worldwide moderate Islamic movement based in Pennsylvania has been providing cover for the CIA since the mid-1990s. The memoir, roughly rendered in English as Witness to Revolution and Near Anarchy, unquote, by retired Turkish intelligence official Osman Nuri Gundes, says the religious tolerance movement, led by an influential former Turkish imam by the name of Fethullah Gulen, has 600 schools and 4 million followers around the world. In the 1990s, Gundes alleges the movement, quote, sheltered 130 CIA agents at its schools in Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan alone, according to a report on his memoir Wednesday by the Paris-based Intelligence Online newsletter. Skipping down. Likewise, Graham Fuller, a former CIA station chief in Kabul and author of The Future of Political Islam, unquote, threw cold water on Gundes's allegations about Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan. Quote, I think the story of 130 CIA agents in Gulen schools in Central Asia is pretty wild, Fuller said by email. I should hasten to add that I left CIA in 1987, nearly 25 years ago, and I have absolutely no concrete personal knowledge whatsoever about this. But my instincts tell me the claim is highly improbable, unquote. Fuller added, I cannot even imagine trying to credibly sell such a scheme with a straight face within the agency. Boy, methinks he doth protest too much. And indeed, I strongly suspect that he was sheep-dipped. Recall that he formed an organization called Chechen International with Uncle Ruslan, who had formerly worked in Central Asia for the Agency for International Development, a common CIA cutout organization. And Uncle Ruslan was the uncle of the Boston Marathon bombers, and he was married formally to Graham Fuller's daughter, and the address for Chechen International was Graham Fuller's Maryland address. And again, it would be pro forma for a veteran and highly placed intelligence officers such as Fuller to, as a matter of course, deny that an organization could have been a CIA front. And for a guy who basically was coordinating Islamist warriors in Kabul, proxy warriors against the former Soviet Union, and who has been an advocate for the Muslim Brotherhood, for him to say, "I cannot even imagine trying to credibly sell such a scheme with a straight face within the agency," again, methinks he doth protest too much. Now, interestingly, Turkey and Erdogan have now turned on the Gulen organization. From the Guardian of December 19th of 2014, Turkey issues arrest warrant for Erdogan rival Fethullah Gulen. This is by Konstanz, C-O-N-S-T-A-N-Z-E, Lech, L-E-T-C-H. It reads in part, "A Turkish court has issued an arrest warrant for the U.S.-based Islamic cleric Fethullah Gulen, a former ally of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who has since become a fierce critic. In his request for the warrant, Istanbul Public Prosecutor Hasan Yılmaz accused Gulen of leading a criminal organization." So exactly what to make of this is a matter of speculation. I want to stress that I have more questions than answers, but I wonder if, rather like Al-Qaeda, rather like other people who were at one point allies of or proteges of elements of U.S. intel, including, by the way, Saddam Hussein at one point. He was put in power by the CIA in a coup in 1968. Erdogan is now turning on the Gulen organization and possibly elements of CIA by extension. By way of conclusion, this past week the stock market has dropped precipitously. It has during the first 2 weeks of the year. Global stock markets have been routed. Among the contributing factors, in addition to perilous economic waters in China, the enormous drop in global oil prices is a major factor. In fact, a number of large oil companies are facing possible bankruptcy charges. In spite of that, Saudi Arabia, the world's largest oil producer and exporter, has not scaled back production at all, which is what it would make sense to do. Saudi Arabia itself has suffered to a certain extent. This is putting a great deal of pressure on Russia, among other countries. We are wondering to what extent this is a replay of the Saudi ramping up of production in 1986, which pulled the bottom out from oil prices and helped to destabilize the former Soviet Union. I would also note that in the late 1990s, Saudi Arabia, in connection with the GOP, George W. Bush, and the petroleum faction of CIA, basically helped to create a phony oil shortage, which in turn helped to ramp up inflation, the price of oil, and destabilize the Carter administration. I wonder to what extent the economic downturn that is fueled in part, no pun intended, by the drop in oil prices, which in turn is being driven by the Saudis' refusal to scale back oil production. I wonder to what extent that will be part of a destabilization of Russia and also perhaps a destabilization of the U.S. as well. It'll be interesting to see what happens with the U.S. economy and whether that helps to bring Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, or Marco Rubio to the White House, along with two Republican houses of Congress. It will also be interesting to see, ultimately, if the attempt at creating a caliphate in Central Asia, perhaps as part of the Caucasus, and which is oil-rich and also oil-rich Xinjiang province in China, also the focal point of Uyghur/Turkophone/Pan-Turkist and Al-Qaeda-connected Islamist activity, if such a caliphate is ultimately established as a result of this destabilization. And if, in fact, it does, how much of it might be Wahhabi, how much of it might be Pan-Turkist, allied with the underground Reich, perhaps? Who knows? But again, against the background of the Earth Island boogie, watch Saudi Arabia and their very curious refusal to cut back production and thereby undercutting and pulling the rug out from under the global economy, the Russian economy in particular. This concludes For the Record program number 886. What the hell does Dave Emery mean by the Earth Island Boogie Part 3? Geopolitical Quicksand. This is being recorded on January 17th of the year 2016. Ciao.